Hello, listeners, and welcome to this first edition of a special monthly program called The Assault on Public Education. I'm Cheryl, a recently retired public school educator. And one of the reasons I retired was this assault on public education. There's a very aggressive agenda by the 1% to privatize the public schools all across America. It's done under the guise of education, quote, reform. This show will expose who's behind this privatization assault on public education, how they go about it, and what you can do about it. With me today to expose this, quote, reform hoax is former state legislator, journalist, and blogger Jonathan Pelto. Jonathan has been monitoring and reporting on this war on public education on his blog called Wait, What? I feel very fortunate that we have someone out there doing what he's doing. Jonathan Pelto, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Could you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today?
So I've been involved in politics for many years. I was elected to the Connecticut House of Representatives in 1984 when I was a senior at the University of Connecticut. Served 10 years, and when my first daughter was born, realized that both the amount of time and the amount of time it took away from the family just wasn't conducive to family life. So after 10 years, I left the legislature and eventually set up a company that worked with progressive organizations around what we called issue advocacy or indirect lobbying. It was to help educate, persuade, mobilize people to speak out on issues when there was legislative action that was going to be taking place. And about now almost 4 years ago, three, 4 years ago, I closed that business. I was really interested in this new developing social media as a place that people were getting information, that as the demise of the quote-unquote mainstream media, a citizen journalism or a advocacy journalism or investigative blogging struck me as something that was likely to start to fill that gap. A good example, when I was a legislator back in the 80s and 90s, there were, I believe, 7 Hartford Current reporters assigned to the Capitol and then 3 or 4 part-timers who would come in during the legislative session. Now there's 1 person at the Capitol and then a couple of extra that are brought in. So the problem is that there really is no mechanism for people to find out about what's going on in politics. So I started a blog called Wait What, or it can be found jonathanpelto.com, but now it's got enough of a following that if people just type in Wait What, it will come up. And I look at Connecticut politics and government, in particular the education issues and these education reform issues. And the blog has been building over the last 3 years, and now I think is a primary mechanism for a lot of people to find out what's going on in state government, and particularly what's going on with these education, quote-unquote, education reform issues. I call it the corporate education reform industry because it really is exactly that, and we can talk about that, but the way I describe it is that in Eisenhower's last speech, just before he left the presidency, he warned the American public about the military-industrial complex and the way in which it was corrupting our democracy and our society. And here was a Republican, a hero, a war hero, somebody who really understood the need for a strong defense, but he also particularly understood just how dangerous it was to have the kind of money that was out there interested in building, creating a military-industrial complex. If he was alive today, I'm absolutely convinced he would be warning us of the education-industrial complex. It is just as serious, if not actually more serious, and it's typified by Rupert Murdoch, the media mogul who owns all kinds of things, but one of the most, arguably one of the most powerful people in the world when it comes to the media. In a speech not too long ago, he talked about K-12 American education as a $500 billion untapped economic market. So there is a industry that has formed that is looking for ways to make money, and they are making hundreds of millions of dollars. And mm-hmm. So my blog and others, really led by Diane Ravitch at the national level, have been investigating, exploring, and writing about whether we call ourselves advocacy journalists or investigative bloggers or citizen journalists. We've been writing about the development of this education reform industry.
Yeah, and I just discovered your blog recently in the last couple of months, and it's really a breath of fresh air. I mean, there's no holds barred there. It's what's really happening, and you don't see that in the newspapers or hear it in anywhere else. So this show is, I hope, the beginning of monthly shows on education and this, quote, education reform movement that's going on. And maybe you can talk a little bit about the, quote, reform. That is it needed? Who's behind it?
Yeah. The quick history of it, I think, is helpful for people, because in Connecticut, we were pretty isolated with these issues until 2012. And really, we haven't seen the rollout until fairly recently. And so I think people are just now catching up on what this issue is about. But it's been around for a while. It started with President George W. Bush, who pushed through the No Child Left Behind, which was supposed to recreate what he had called the Texas Miracle, which was improved test scores and the privatization of Texas public school systems. And then what happened was, when President Obama was elected, he actually expanded it. That this is one of those issues where the leadership of both the Democrat and Republican parties have really been pushing these reforms, and we can talk about why, but the industry, the reform industry, has spent huge amounts of money, both in its efforts to give campaign contributions and its efforts to run public relations campaigns. So whether it was President Bush or President Obama, the approach to policy was almost exactly the same. In President Obama's case, it was called Race to the Top, and he put in his friend Arne Duncan as the Secretary of Education. And their goal was to create the sense that there was a true crisis, and that the way to deal with that crisis in education was really to hand over more and more schools to private companies to run. It's a very complex set of circumstances that have developed, but fundamentally there was the belief that the private sector would do a better job, that why don't we run our schools like a business? And if we had a common set of standards, for example, then all children would immediately be able to push towards those standards. And we know, parents everywhere know, that every child can learn and succeed, but not all children learn at the same pace or at the same rate or at the same time. But what the education reform industry is really built on is the notion that you can standardize that. The money behind the industry, and there's a lot of money behind the industry, but the three biggest external players are Bill Gates, the Melinda and Bill Gates Foundation, the Walton Foundation, which is the foundation that is the Walmart family, and what's called the Broad Foundation, Eli Broad, a billionaire from Southern California. The easiest way to think about what they want to do is to think about Bill Gates's view of the world. And that was, he set out to create a standard set of programs that wherever you opened them up on any machine, they would all look and act exactly the same. And I think he genuinely believed, and his children did not go through the regular school system, and you know, may not have ever had the kind of contacts that would teach a normal person that children are not computers. But this is their strategy, in addition to trying to make a lot of money, is the notion that no matter what school you go into, it would be exactly the same, just like the Microsoft Office. And so when you clicked on Word, you'd get Word. When you wanted students to know something, you'd click on that, and a student in every place would know that. And it failed to recognize that, first off, the American education system is not broken. Our test scores are the highest they've ever been. Our dropout rates are the lowest they've ever been. We have an increasingly educated population. In fact, one would argue that our economy is so weak that we're not utilizing the productivity that we already have in place, let alone the quality of the education. And any parent, I think, or almost any parent, who has children in schools now recognize that, because children are coming home with homework that we never saw when we were in school. And the fact is that the vast majority of our schools are succeeding. There is what is called an achievement gap, and that is there's significant differences between those that come from households that don't face poverty, households where English is the spoken language, and communities in which they are providing good services to students with special education needs. We then have communities that have lots of poverty and where there are significant barriers, English language barriers, and where there is inadequate support for children with special education needs. Every study ever done has shown that the greatest predictors of test scores are poverty, language barriers, and special education issues. But those are hard to solve, and they take government programs that are committed and dedicated to those areas, and there's not a lot of place to make money. And so what the education reform industry has done is it's sold us a bill of goods that if we just had a common set of standards and a set of new tests, all of which are done on computers, so we would need to buy all new computers, we would need to develop all new curriculum, we would need to buy all new textbooks, we would need to teach to these higher standards, then all of our problems would go away.
And somebody will make huge profits off of all of that.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Plus, isn't there, in all of this, isn't there also an attempt to do away with unions and to have corporate control over what students are learning?
I think that there is. The way it works usually is that they will go into urban areas and they will announce that after this round of testing that's taking place or after an assessment of how schools are doing, that the solution is to give the lowest performing schools over to a private entity to run. In Hartford, we're starting to see schools that were redesigned once now being, quote unquote, redesigned a second time in a matter of just years, because what happens is you can give it to a private company, but if it's not dealing with the issues of poverty and language barriers and special ed, and in fact, what we're witnessing is exactly the opposite is happening, because once you work in a profit motive, then you need to find savings. And so where do those people find savings? Well, they find savings by going to larger classes, by reducing the kinds of courses. I mean, one of the saddest commentaries about education today is that the things that we all thought were part of going to school, art, music, PE, are called specials. And they either have little to no specials, or the special comes on a little cart where you get 15 minutes of art. And that's all part of an effort to reduce costs so that they can increase profits.
Yeah, and maybe you can talk a little bit about the difference between a private school and a charter school, because when they privatize the charter schools, they're finding a way of getting public money, whereas a private school is paid for by the parents.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, the easiest way to do it is to think of a charter school as a publicly funded private school. When a charter company is selected to run a school or retained to run a school, they get to keep all of the public dollars that was already being spent. And they're often then given additional dollars as management fees. So the costs can be even higher than they would be in a traditional public school. On top of that, in Connecticut, not only are the charter schools funded by the state, and many of them are given extra money, but they don't have to pay for the transportation of the children. The town still does. And they don't have to pay for the special education costs. The town still does. So that while the charter schools have been pushing for and under Governor Malloy have gotten significant increases, while regular schools have gotten virtually no increases, what the charter school companies don't tell you is that two of the major costs, transportation and special ed, are still paid for by the local taxpayers on top of all of the money that was going to the school. The second thing that happens is that there is really no oversight. Because the charter schools do not report to the local Board of Education, and because the State Board of Education approves them for 3 or 5 year charters, and then there's really no oversight system, that you have problems that go unaddressed. And the third major problem with charter schools is that in Connecticut, they were originally designed to help with the racial isolation issue. What legislators and government officials were told was that if you allow charter schools into a community, they will do a better job of pulling students from a cross-section. Instead, we found we have 18 charter schools in Connecticut. All but one of them is more racially isolated than the community that they're from. So they have done exactly the opposite of what they were supposed to do. The second thing they do is almost across the board, they discriminate against children who have English language barriers. So in places like Hartford or New Haven or Bridgeport, what the charter schools are doing is they're refusing to take their fair share. And as those communities have an increasingly large number of students who need English language help, the charter schools are refusing to take those children. Or if they get in, they're then what they call out-migrated. They're sent back into the public schools. And also, charter schools take very few special ed students. If in the average school in Connecticut, we're now running 10 to 13% special education students, charter schools maybe will have 3 or 4%. And they'll take those or keep those special ed students who don't have very significant problems. So the students who have English language challenges and who come from the poorest backgrounds and who have special education needs are left in the quote-unquote traditional public schools. The charter schools then say, look at, our test scores are higher. But of course, they're higher because they refuse to take the students that traditionally bring down test scores because they require more work. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that the urban school districts end up having more and more problems. The charter schools get more and more money with creaming the students who are most likely to do well. And so each time then you see as political leadership, again, both Republicans and Democrats, saying, well, see, charter schools are better, so let's give them even more control, when in fact just the same pattern keeps happening over and over again.
So charter schools can select who they take for their students. And what about unions? Do they have teacher unions?
Most are not unionized. Certainly all of the major ones are not unionized, have traditionally not been unionized. So there are issues about salary and benefits being different. There are work schedules that are different. The charter schools will tell you that they have an open enrollment process, that anybody can put their name in for the lottery. We've investigated, and people can read about it on my blog, that there are some very serious accusations that have been leveled about the lotteries not being fair, that they've been controlled in such a way to only select the children that they want. For example, one of the most obvious ways is that if most of the recruitment is done in English, and if the meetings that you have to attend are in English, then you are by default not going to get as many non-English speaking families attending that. Mm-hmm. The second one is that they have significant enrollment dropout rates. Connecticut measures two different things. It represents what it calls dropouts. That is when a child leaves school completely. And then it measures enrollment levels. What the charter schools say is we have very low dropout rates. That is because when a child leaves the charter school, they automatically are re-entered into the public school. And then when they leave the public school, they are then treated as a dropout. So what we did, and there's some charts on my blog that show that, is that we looked at enrollment decline as opposed to dropout. And for example, in New Haven, we listed all of the high schools. And the high schools that lost the most students were the charter schools, because what they do is they counsel out anybody who they think is not going to keep their test scores high or anybody that doesn't meet their expectations. And that often is children that need some extra help, special ed, language barriers, children with behavioral issues. Most of these charter schools have a policy of what they call no excuse, no excuses, which is really a euphemism for if you have any behavioral problems, you'll get thrown out. There was a major controversy when a study came out last year that in the charter schools in Hartford, almost 85% of the kindergarteners faced some kind of suspension versus only 3 or 6% in the public schools. That what these schools do is they have such strict discipline as a way to force out anybody who isn't going to fit the mold. And they do it in very humiliating ways. Children who are in any trouble have to wear a different colored shirt so that they are humiliated with their colleagues at Capital Prep, a magnet school in Hartford. Children have to sit at what's called the table of shame. If they've, for example, worn a brown belt when they were supposed to be wearing a black belt with that uniform, they're made to eat standing up. They're made to stand during entire academic class periods. They're made to stand facing the wall for hours at a time. I mean, these are things that I think are child abuse, and yeah, now people are finally stepping forward, and these allegations will be investigated, and I think that there will be significant punishments forthcoming. But what charter schools do is they serve a very small subset. There's only about less than 5% of the students are in charter schools in Connecticut, but they disproportionately take actually more than their fair share of the money and take far less than their share of the students that need those extra help.
So this is really a setup. The financial backers and pushers of this, quote, reform have really thought it out well. It's such a devious system that they've created to leave no corporation behind.
Right. A perfect example, the superintendent of Bridgeport who's just left last week, a guy named Paul Vallis, he was instrumental in the privatization effort in Chicago that continues to this day. Then he went to Philadelphia. Now 40% of all children in the Philadelphia school system are in charter schools, and it will be pushing up towards 50%. Then he went to New Orleans. New Orleans is 100% charter schools. There is no public education system in New Orleans. Technically five schools left, but it's fundamentally a privatized system. It's also a system in which, when Katrina came through, they fired all of the teachers, every single one, top to bottom, and then set up a system in which no unionization could occur. So oftentimes what these privatizers do is they set it up in such a way that you can't have unionized teachers. He then left New Orleans and came to Bridgeport. He was only here for 2 years before people caught on, and he was finally pushed out. But a good example of how they work is that within the first, I'd say, 6 to 8 weeks that he was here, he had signed more than a dozen no-bid contracts for over $12 million. That money included all new textbooks. They did need some textbooks, but he had a major contract with a textbook company that he had done business with in the past. But because they didn't have the money, the way they did it was that they would pay for it over 5 years. So then he did that, and then he left town. And now the taxpayers of Bridgeport are left with having to pick up the tab, which means programs will be cut in order to fulfill a contract that was signed earlier to provide a product that was not actually the kind of exact product that they needed. A perfect example of that was that the Bridgeport school system had decided years ago that seniors in high school would do better in English rather than studying traditional English literature, would look at contemporary literature, African American literature, Latin American literature, literature that resonated with an urban population so that they would understand that regardless of background or language, literature had a profound impact on society. The textbooks that Paul Vallis bought were all traditional British literature. So even though they had a very good curriculum, they had teachers trained, they were working very well, he just unilaterally decided that from now on, those children were going to be learning about Chaucer and Shakespeare instead of anything that was really relevant to the world around them.
Yeah.
And that's a good example, because what the reformers do is they say, we need everything new, and we need to buy that from vendors. And we won't even bother with the competitive bidding process. We'll just go full steam ahead. It's what the Commissioner of Education did at the state level when he got here. It's what Paul Vallis did. It's what Stephen Adamowski did, who used to be the superintendent of Hartford and is now the quote-unquote special master of Wyndham and New London, is that they would spend huge amounts of money, particularly on computers and software and textbooks, for the short-term benefit of saying, look, we have all new stuff, but in the process having to cut the number of teachers or cut the number of programs, leaving the students far worse off than they were before.
So the charter schools can pick and choose who they have, so they get the cream of the crop, and so their test scores look better. But I thought I read in Diane Ravitch's book that overall, when you put all the charter schools together with all the public schools, they don't do any better than the public schools.
That's right. Once you factor in the students that they're taking, and that if you compare that cohort of students, they do no better and they usually do worse. The reason that they quote-unquote look better is that they then have creamed off, for example, in Hartford, they've creamed off students that are less likely to be poor, have fewer language barriers, and have far fewer special education needs. They then are comparing that apples to oranges. The studies that have been done that are comparing apples to apples or oranges to oranges find out that charter schools traditionally don't do better, that they have significant financial problems because of the profit motive brings in all kinds of problems that don't traditionally exist in the public sector. And the other is just the whole fallacy that the test scores are the end-all, the be-all and the end-all. If you take suburban students in Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, they are scoring at the very top of the student population around the world, probably 1, 2, and 3. you hear about America's low test scores. And that is, again, because we test, as a country, we test everybody. Nobody does more standardized testing than the United States. We also, when we do the testing, we include all students. When you compare it against other countries that are very selective, because they've already, many of them are either very homogeneous countries, so you look at Norway and Finland and Sweden and countries that have very homogeneous populations will traditionally score well because there's not as much poverty, there's very little language barriers, and they're very aggressive in dealing with special education. So they get good scores. And then when you look at countries, particularly some of the Asian countries that do well, what they don't tell the public is that that's just a subset of the students who are taking those scores. So again, Obama, Bush, the Arne Duncans of the world say things like, we're 24th in the world. That is so incredibly misleading as to really be a lie. And they say we should be first in the world. Well, when you look at the students who don't face the challenges, we are first in the world. And so the problem is, how do we deal with those that are facing challenges? And having them take more tests is not the answer. Dealing with the problem is the answer. But it doesn't fit their narrative. They have created a narrative, which is America is failing. And what's so interesting, and the reason I bring up the Eisenhower quote, is that in the 50s and into the 60s, in order to create the Cold War, there was the narrative that the United States was about to be attacked, that we had to do this, because if we didn't, we would be wiped out. And therefore, Americans went along with a system that basically privatized all of the military except for the troops, but all of the equipment and the extraordinary costs that went with it. For all intents and purposes, this is the same narrative, slightly different. But basically what they're telling people is America is failing. We're going to get blown out of the water. Our society will be destroyed if you don't hand over all of your money to the private sector to run your schools. When the one thing that's always been so great about the United States is that we have had universal educational opportunity, and there are issues and problems, and there are solutions to those issues and problems, and we could be doing that, and in fact, they would be far less expensive.
And the irony is, if poverty is the key issue here, which all the research points to, yet our government is doing nothing to create more jobs and improve our failing economy. In fact, if the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, which Obama is pushing, gets approved, the economy will probably get a whole lot worse, and we'll see more and more students sinking into poverty and a broadening of the achievement gap. So as you said, they're not addressing the real issues.
They're not addressing the real issues. Yeah. There are programs around the country that are good models about how to get parents more involved, how to deal with students who are going home to households in which English is not the spoken language. We know what works, and that is when you have stable, suburban, middle-class households, for the most part, where students are going home and they get some help with their homework, and students do relatively well compared to students who are living in poverty, don't have enough food, often have either one or no one at home at much of the day because
their parents
are working multiple jobs, or that they come from single mother households, that they're going home to households that don't have the skill set to help them or the language experience to help them with their homework. And then perhaps the most shocking of all is that what we find in suburban areas where they have good programs to identify and support special education students, the number of whom are on the rise in this country for disconcerting reasons, environmental pollutants and others, are really beginning to take a toll. And we're seeing a major increase in autism and other kinds of special education needs. School districts that can afford it are, for the most part, stepping forward and helping. But those are often the students who fall through the cracks in the urban areas.
Yeah. Now, Jonathan, we talked a little bit about No Child Left Behind and where that came from. And from that, we got the high stakes testing in Connecticut, the Connecticut Mastery Test, and in the high school, the CAP test. Also, part of No Child Left Behind was that every student would reach 100% mastery on these annual tests by 2014, which, of course, is absurd. And now we have Obama's race to the top, which allows a state to get a waiver from No Child Left Behind and also brings in the Common Core state standards, the new tests, which in Connecticut is the SBAC, and the new teacher evaluation system. So maybe you could talk about that waiver and what it gives us. And
right. I guess the way to describe it best was that we went from out of the frying pan and into the fire and we really sold the bill of goods that No Child Left Behind was a failed program. It was unrealistic. It didn't provide sufficient funds. It required this orientation towards testing without dealing with the factors that we just talked about, so that some students tested relatively well and some students tested not so well, and that the test became the predominant factor. And it said that everybody was going to succeed at testing, just miraculously was going to succeed at testing. And if you didn't, then you would lose your federal money and bad things would happen. So when the Obama administration took over, what they said was, we will allow you to get out of No Child Left Behind if you get into Race to the Top, which was sort of a hangman's choice, because nobody could then stay in the No Child Left Behind because it was designed in such a way that nobody could succeed. The other piece was that Obama put some initial significant money behind Race to the Top. It was mostly competitive, so that the money went to certain districts or certain towns. But even in the stimulus package, there was a lot of money, but you had to agree. So we were sort of bribed into saying, well, we will agree to Race to the Top. So what's Race to the Top? Race to the Top was really, and the Common Core concept had started before then, but really grew under Obama. The Common Core was the notion that we would create standards that were high enough to ensure that every child could go to college or was quote-unquote career ready, so that you would actually say that not only do you have to take tests, but the tests are going to be much more difficult. And secondly, they implemented the Common Core and the Common Core testing pretty much at the same time, so that there was a relatively secret behind-the-scenes development of the Common Core, which was done with not a lot of teacher development and mostly done by these corporate education reform consultants and the people that would either behind the corporate education reform industry or who would benefit from it. And they then developed the tests, but they didn't ever develop the curriculum because the federal law is very clear. The federal government can't set a national curriculum. They can set national standards, or they can trick states into doing national standards. The way that for most people, if they get a sense of how that happened, they may remember how we got the 55-mile-hour speed limit or how we got the 21-age drinking. What the federal government said was, if you want your transportation money, you have to adopt those. There was nothing that said that you had to increase the drinking age to 21 or that you had to adopt a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. But if you didn't, then you didn't get the money. So states did it. Well, this was exactly the same thing. You had, in essence, you had to adopt the Common Core. And with the Common Core standards came the Common Core testing. The curriculum was going to be developed, quote unquote, locally. And so it would arguably take years to develop a new set of standards and then develop a curriculum and then develop a test. But it was all pushed through. The standards were released in 2008, and Connecticut's about 2 years behind. So by 2011, a number of states were already, New York was already using the Common Core test last year. Florida and New York are two examples that were ahead of us, and they give completely opposite pictures of what happens. Under the Connecticut Mastery Test, and the test that most of us are used to having seen our children go through, is that about 80% of the children are at goal. The number drops in urban areas, and it drops particularly with children who face language barriers or special education needs or have greater poverty. So there you might get down at the 45 or 50 or 55% level, and in suburban areas you get at the 70, 80, 90% level. The Common Core test is designed in such a way that at most only about 25% of the kids are going to be at that proficient goal. It's designed to say which of these kids are, quote unquote, college ready. And because the burden is so high that in both Florida and New York, which had very traditionally 70, 75% of the kids doing fine, after they completed the first round of testing, they came back with only about 25% of the kids were at goal. Florida held an emergency State Board of Ed meeting, and they changed what's called the cut score. Where do you cut? What number gives you proficiency versus not? What number gives you goal versus not? And within hours, Florida changed theirs and went back to 75%. They simply took the harder test, but then said that a lower score meant proficient. New York said no. Governor Cuomo, who, like Governor Malloy, is very much behind the education reform industry and is funded in many ways. Their campaigns are funded by the education reform industry. They said, no, we're going to show parents that your kids are not that smart and that they're not going to do well. And so there was a real uprising in New York because parents know perfectly well that many of their schools are working fine, their kids are doing well, they're learning the things, they're getting into college, that the test itself was at fault, that the way the test was scored was at fault. In New York City, 3% of the non-English-speaking students scored at a proficient level. We know that there are lots and lots and lots of very smart students who don't happen to speak English. They may be learning English over time, but you know, when you look at who gets the Nobel Prizes, it's hardly always the English-speaking people because smart people come in all shapes and sizes and from all different countries. So what the industry wanted was really a system to convince parents that the education system was broken and that their children were not doing well. And Connecticut, this year, we are, quote-unquote, field testing this new Common Core test, and then next year it will be mandatory. And I think that we will see exactly the same thing, and that is that where we have had a good education system, both, of course, in the suburban areas, but the cities have come along well in developing programs, everybody will now be told that they're failing in the hopes that that will mean more privatization, more outside consultants, more software, more computers, and people making a lot more money at the expense of our children.
Right, because isn't it in the law if a significant amount of, there's a certain percentage of students that fail the test or don't meet the standard, then the state can come in and fire principals and teachers and make the school a charter school if they choose to do that.
That's right. Yeah. And the way that it's set up is, there will always be that lowest percentage. So every year you will have a set of schools that are ripe for takeover. And we've already seen that in Connecticut. We saw the Milner School in Hartford, an elementary school. Very close by was something called the Jamoke Academy, which is a charter school that in its history had not taken a single non-English speaking student and who had virtually no special education students below 2% or so. The head of the Jamoke Academy went before the legislature to talk about their model. And when asked, how is it that you have so few special education students? He said that they have a program that in kindergarten, they can identify and cure students of their special education needs, which of course is beyond absurd. But mm-hmm. He said it in a public hearing. And legislators said, wow, that's, you know, some legislators said that's really impressive. What they do is the reason they don't have any special education students is they provide no special education programs. So if you get into their charter school and your child needs any special education, what they say is, well, you really should go back to the Hartford school system because they have those programs. And it was a school that had never taken a non-English speaking student in, I think, 8 years. Next door, right down the street, was the Milner School, about half non-English-speaking, half African-American. And it was a school that was having a lot of issues when it came to test scores because it was 100% poverty. 50% of the children were going home to households that didn't speak English. Significant amounts of special ed students. And so what the Commissioner of Education, Stephen Pryor, did was he took over the Milner School and gave it to the Jamoke Academy to run and paid the Jamoke Academy a management fee, plus allowed the Jamoke Academy to get rid of all of the teachers who were at Milner, and they then got moved to other schools. There's only been 1 year, so we don't know the details of exactly what happened, but we can guess, and that is the number of non-English-speaking students is going to drop. Halfway through their first year, they still had not hired an ESL teacher. And that when it was a school that had a lot of special ed students, we will assume that they will have sent those kids packing. Why you would take a Hartford neighborhood school and give it to a charter school operator who had no experience with those students really says a lot about who's in it to make the money. Adding insult to injury, that same Jamoke Academy was then given a school, again, with no experience in Hartford, with no evidence that they had succeeded, was given a neighborhood school in Bridgeport called the Dunbar School. So it's now Jamoke Academy, Jamoke at Milner, Jamoke at Dunbar. Jamoke Academy set up a charter school management company to run all these schools. The chief operating officer sits on the State Board of Education. So the conflict of interest is so great that taxpayer dollars being really sent in a counterproductive way. But that conflict of interest is no different than the Commissioner of Education in Connecticut, Stephen Pryor, co-founded the Achievement First charter school chain. Achievement First is a large charter school company that runs schools in New York, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. He co-founded the company. He served on their board of directors until just before he resigned to become Commissioner of Education. And no charter school operator has had as much financial benefit over the last 3 years than the company, Achievement First, than the company that he came from. So what we're seeing is that these education reformers, as they call themselves, go back in and back out into the system, exactly the way that it happens in the military-industrial complex. You hear all the time about consultants who then become government employees. They're government employees. They then go back into the consulting business.
So they regulate themselves.
Where they regulate themselves. Yeah. Exactly. And these charter school companies become, some of their people become commissioners and superintendents, principals, and then turn around and hire the companies that they came from. And we're seeing multiple examples of that in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And
so what's going on with our legislature? I mean, I understand the governor, he's high on one of the commissions that's pushing this. And I know it's a bipartisan issue. I mean, it doesn't matter which side of the aisle are on you. They're all pushing this. But what's wrong with our legislators? Why aren't they responsive to the people in this?
You know, and I'd like to believe that they understood what they were voting for. In the last few months, as people have finally woken up, you hear more and more legislators saying, well, quite frankly, I didn't understand, or this wasn't what I was told. The way that the legislature works now is very different than it was 30 years ago, 25 years ago when I was in the legislature, where it was expected that every member really try to read the bills and understand. Now it's driven much more by leadership that will say, this is the agreement, you have to vote for it. Governor Malloy introduced the most anti-teacher, anti-union, anti-public school initiative of any Democratic governor in the country. So while it's bipartisan, there are a handful of Democrats that are at the most extreme end of the pro-corporate movement. And Dan Malloy is chief among them. The Governor Cuomo in New York is probably a close second. But when it comes to education reform issues, there's no difference in policy, virtually no difference in policy between Governor Christie and Governor Malloy. When he pushed this starting in 2012 and he introduced the bill and he got the support of the leadership of the House and the Senate, it passed 146 to nothing in the House, and it passed overwhelmingly in the Senate, and Republicans voted for it as much as Democrats did. So legislators, I think, just believed that or didn't bother to look or understand what was in there. I think suburban legislators thought that the problems were just going to be focused in on the urban areas and that it wasn't their district.
Well,
so
and is it also
they
that they wanted the money attached to race to the top, so it's a whole package, you have to take all of it or none of it?
That was certainly one of the stronger arguments, that we need this, we need to get the money from the, of course, we haven't gotten Race to the Top money. We tried, Connecticut applied 3 times and got rejected 3 times, even though we've developed this bill that meets all of the specifications. So the whole thing, I think, is a sham. But yeah, legislators would say we did it for that reason. But the amount of damage that they're doing across the board, not just in the urban areas, the unfair, first off, the Common Core and the Common Core testing is absurd. Secondly, and it's unfair to students, it's unfair to teachers, it is a prescription for disaster. Then to use those test scores to evaluate teachers, even a portion of that to evaluate teachers, they have created a system in which teachers cannot succeed. And we know that the vast majority...
It's a punitive system.
It is a very punitive system. It is going to push out a lot of very good people. It is going to end up hurting suburban districts as much as urban districts. And my guess is that within 2 or 3 or 4 years, enough legislators will have woken up that they will, either with a new governor or with this governor, will force changes, I think, quite likely with a new governor, because I think the reaction is going to be so negative among parents over the course of the next year that there will be a lot who will not want to vote for any of the incumbents because of what they've done to Connecticut's public education system.
Yeah, I just retired from public education in December because I couldn't tolerate what was being done, and I felt I could be a stronger voice from the outside than from the inside. And I see what it's doing to teachers. They don't want to come to work anymore. They're really unhappy. It doesn't give them any freedom to do the fun stuff with the kids and be creative. And they say that it's developmentally inappropriate, the Common Core, and that they're teaching now things that were in third grade. Now they're teaching things that were normally taught in fifth grade. And as you go down to kindergarten, sometimes it's just really developmentally inappropriate. I mean, it's just
That's
not going
right.
to happen.
There's a discussion that can take place about what should the standards be. Connecticut has traditionally had very high standards, and teachers developed curriculum off of those standards, and they taught to those standards, and children scored very well on those standards. It was Malloy who said, I don't mind teaching to the test as long as the test scores go up. Which was a real notion that somehow everything is about test scores, when we know, parents know, teachers know, everybody knows that children don't all learn at the same time. And in some ways, some of Connecticut's standards were better than the Common Core standards, and some of them could have been brought up. But instead of having that debate, they immediately went to this new system because it was an all or nothing, in the sense that education, corporate reform, movement, they want the money. And to get the money, one of the best examples of all, is that all of us who ever took any kinds of tests knew that they were those bubble tests back as far back as, you know, we can remember. They weren't necessarily showing up in school, but at least they showed up at the SATs or the LSATs or the PSATs or whatever it was. Connecticut then had Connecticut Mastery Test, where students were being tested and tested and tested and prepped for testing. So what the education reform industry said is we want it all done on computers, which required then purchase of all new computers, all new software. The problems have been tremendous because very few of the schools have the bandwidth that allows them to even take the tests all at the same time. In Hartford, in Bridgeport, in Windham, there are stories that they have yet to get through a testing round because the software crashes the entire system. And it's not ready for prime time. It is the wrong policy, but it was the way to make a lot of money. And to describe how bad it's gotten, the legislature actually, it used to be that kids would start getting tested at third grade. The new rounds of tests, although the Common Core test will continue at third grade, we've now expanded the quote-unquote assessments, the standardized assessments, to kindergarten. So in Connecticut, we will be giving 3- and 4-year-olds standardized tests and measurements and recording that and collecting that data and storing that data. And we'll do it from kindergarten all the way through. And it is disgusting, doesn't even begin to describe
right.
the unfairness to the right. students, to the parents, to the teachers, and quite frankly, I think to society, because we will create a generation of students who will hate school on top of all of the angst that comes with students anyway.
And their teachers will hate being there too, and it's not going to be a nice place to be. Let me ask you, in the time we have left, what can be done? What can unions do? What can teachers do? What can parents do? What can students do to resist this and counteract it and get our system back into public hands again?
Yeah. First and foremost, parents and even teachers, I think, are really now starting to understand just how damaging this was. Because there was so much money in the marketing of the programs, and because they were pushed through so quickly. I mean, Connecticut had really not seen any of this until January of 2012. So it's only less than 2 years. And parents and teachers and public school advocates are just catching up. The other group that I think still doesn't understand are taxpayers and the burden that's going to fall on taxpayers, because the state is not picking up the costs. So it's going to fall on the back of taxpayers. And that means that it will mean higher taxes. And it will also mean that programs will have to be devoted to the testing as opposed to creating well-rounded students. So there will be less music, less art, less any program that's not part of the standardized testing. So first and foremost is to learn about it And that is now becoming a little bit easier. There's a lot of different blogs. There's a lot of different things online. The single best source is dianeravitch.net, DianeRavitch, dianeravitch.net. She's really the leader in the country. I cover a lot of this in Connecticut. My blog is WaitWhat, jonathanpelto.com. There's another good blog out there. It's called the publicschoolshakedown.org. But by searching for that, by watching for it, by reading and going to meetings at the local level, but the single biggest thing is that state legislators and state senators, and this is an election year, it's not just the governor. It's true that the governor, in this case, is the one who's pushing it more than anybody else. But it can't pass. It can't happen. It can be rolled back if state legislators roll it back. There are 187 state senators and state representatives, 151 members of the House, 36 members of the Senate. Every one of them is up for election. Every one of them is supposed to be representing their district, not doing just what the governor tells them to do. And quite frankly, having been a legislator and then having been involved in advocacy work, the single most important thing that can happen is that between now and November, legislators are confronted about the damage done by their legislation and told that if something isn't done, that they won't receive the votes they need to get reelected.
Yeah, so be vocal and contact them, right? And what about parents? Now, I know there's a website called United Opt Out where parents can opt out of the testing, and it tells them how to do it. And there's
right.
Parents around the country are doing that. Maybe you could talk about
and
that.
And there are big efforts going on where there's a number of them going on in Connecticut, Opt Out, United Opt Out. There's one called Fair Test. There are links on my website as well. There is a growing recognition that, first off, it is not healthy for children to be tested this much. It's not healthy for the system. By opting out children, you do two things. One is you protect your child, and the other is you make a powerful statement. This whole system is based on their desire to make these tests drive the system. And if enough parents opt their children out, the system will collapse in on itself. And that's why they're pushing back so much. This commissioner, this governor and this commissioner have sent out memos to superintendents. Again, the links can be found on my website that actually lay out how they're supposed to mislead parents and intimidate parents into thinking that they can't opt out. You can opt out in Connecticut. There is absolutely nothing that the state can do to you if you want to opt your child out. But this administration has gone to such an extreme to scare parents into thinking that and telling teachers that they can't actually tell their parents and students what their rights are. So it's going to take some time, but this opt-out movement is taking hold in New York, where more than 50% of the principals in the state of New York have signed a letter urging people to opt out. So school administrators know they just aren't speaking up enough in Connecticut. But as they see their colleagues in other states do it, I think we'll start seeing more and more administrators saying, my obligation is to my children, and I'm not going to be following the company line any longer.
Yeah. So power to the people. Huh? Let's get out there and do
Absolutely.
Our work. Otherwise, we're going to have an education system that will be just a real disgrace. That will be a total sham, and it will be run by the corporate world.
And it will hurt children across the board. These are policies that will do damage to any listener's school district. This isn't just about Hartford or Bridgeport. This is about every single town in Connecticut.
Yeah. Jonathan Pelto, thank you very much for being on the show today. It's been really informative. I have been studying this, but I learned a really lot from just listening to you today.
Thank you.
You just heard an interview with Jonathan Pelto. And again, his website is jonathanpelto.com. It has a wealth of information on the assault on public education in Connecticut and what our state government's involvement in this is. I would encourage you to check it out. It's interesting to note that the privatization efforts of the elite when it comes to public education is not just happening in Connecticut and the U.S., but around the world. It's in Mexico, India, and other countries. And it's not really an isolated issue with just education. In our own country, we've seen the privatization of health insurance, prisons, many military operations, intelligence, bioweapons research and production, the post office, pensions, even fire departments in some areas. And the global elite are also pushing this agenda around the globe. For example, in Iraq, after it fell, they privatized most of their public institutions. And privatization of traditional public institutions like education that serve us all is never good for the public, the taxpayers. Since profit is now involved, services get cut, and since the institution is no longer under public control, all accountability is lost. Unfortunately, much of the privatization process has been hidden from us, or, as in education, slipped in under the guise of doing something good for us. The corporate media is owned by the 1% and does their bidding. So if you want the truth about what's happening, you have to look elsewhere. So I'm going to repeat the alternative sources that were already mentioned on the show and add a few more. So we have Diane Ravitch's book called The Reign of Error. There's her website, Diane Ravitch, and that's Ravitch is R-A-V-I-T-C-H, DianeRavitch.com. Then we have JonathanPelto.com. And the following websites, www.networkforpubliceducation.org, parentsacrossamerica.org, realhartford.org, badassteacher.org, and unitedoptout.com. And this unitedoptout.com, I really want to recommend because it has a lot of information on there by state about what's going on and the testing that's involved and all of that. And it also has resources about what you can do. So I would really encourage you to check that one out, unitedoptout.com. And I want to thank you all for listening today to the first edition of The Assault on Public Education. It'll be archived on the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit for radioforall.net. To access the show, click on Contributor and then Cheryl with a C, and the show should pop up. And I'm going to close the show today with the first part of a song by Van Morrison called Educating Archie. And here it is. By the media. Yeah.